We're nearly there, ladies and gentlemen. Very, very close, crackheads. We are 2 days away now from UFC Freedom 250, UFC at the White House, whatever you want to call it. Some massive fights going down. One of the most unique backdrops to a fight I think we'll ever see is going to happen on Sunday. A lot of people feel a lot of different ways about it, of course, and we've talked about that for probably the last 11 months. It's a long, long time to be talking about an event, but we're nearly there. We're nearly ready to sink our teeth into some fantastic fistic fury on the South Lawn of the White House. How crazy is this? It's absolutely insane. But there are some delicious fights to look forward to, of course, on Sunday. We're in the midst of a World Cup, of course. The New York Knicks and the San Antonio Spurs are going out in the NBA Finals. There's a lot happening. But I think for Sunday, the world is going to be transfixed on the UFC, on the White House, on our sport. And I cannot wait to see how it goes down. And before we bring in my beautiful co-hosts, two of the greatest journalists of all time, we've got a quick message from our friends over at Kalshi. That's right. This episode is sponsored by Kalshi, the largest prediction market in the United States. Here's what makes Kalshi different. You are not playing against a house. Kalshi is peer-to-peer trading. You buy yes or no contract on whether something will happen, and you're trading directly against other users. Think of it like buying or selling a stock. The line isn't set by some algorithm working against you. Public opinion sets the price. Kalshi is CFTC approved, federally regulated, which is why it's available all across the country, including California and Texas. Download the Kalshi app and use code CRAIC, C-R-A-I-C, to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade what's next. And thank you very much to our beautiful friends over at Kalshi. And now I can introduce my wonderful friends, Chuck Bendenhall, all the way over in Washington, D.C. And Ben Folks, who's just in his house like me. But I mean, you know, that's okay. I mean, we're allowed to be in our house. Chuck, you're more important than us. You are. Is it the nation's capital? It's the nation's capital, right? Yeah.
The nation's capital.
What, yeah. Got it. Yeah, man. Yeah, that's where the White House is, the nation's capital, bro.
I know now. Okay? I won't ask again.
I want to talk about Chuck's hotel room back there.
Yeah,
that looks like nice. A nice hotel room. What's going on with the expenses on this one? Because when I stay at a hotel, I'm budget conscious. I'm thinking about the big picture. Chuck is over here.
That's your problem, mate.
Just wheeling and dealing. What's going on,
Chuck? You can make all that out from just seeing this bed right here. This is about the entire room, Ben. I'm not going to lie to you. This is not a very expensive hotel.
There aren't any bullet holes in the walls or anything. I don't understand.
That's true. That part is true. I haven't seen any, so that's good. And honestly, that's all I'm looking for. If it's without bullet holes, I'm okay staying here.
You got a rope? You got a free rope in there?
There's no rope.
Oh, no, okay.
There is an iron.
I take it all back.
When you tuned in from a hotel room, I believe there was a snack counter. I don't see a snack counter on Chuck's, okay?
Look, that was me traveling on personal business when there was a snack counter. And that is the thing. This has been an issue.
Who's traveling that way?
When I travel with my wife sometimes and I'm tagging along while she's going to dance events and things like that. And when she picks the hotel, let me tell you, ain't no snack counters around.
Yeah.
When I pick the hotel, snacks. Yeah. I'm going first class or I don't go at all. It's become a thing. We're planning a trip coming up, and I'm just like, oh, we're flying into Newark? You can fly into Newark if you want. I'm a LaGuardia man, okay? That's just the way it is, and you're going to have to deal with it.
I'm more of a helipad man. They just put me on a roof somewhere, you know what I mean?
Big time Chuck Mendenhall.
Hey. We are on bought time here. Chuck had to get a late checkout just so he could be on the show with us today
and
give us
that,
the down loan.
Because I've got street cred with these people.
I can't do it. They won't let me.
Chuck, tell us. Give us what you have seen so far since you've been in Washington, D.C. Have you seen the claw? I believe you have. And what up close and personals have you got with the event so far?
Well, so far, I've seen the claw pretty up close, but I was not able to go down and really look inside of it, you know, like some of these other guys. But I could see enough. It's a complete obstruction. It looks like a huge bouncy castle, like in front of the in front of the White House. But it is fairly impressive, man. And that, like, you know, anybody who knows you're here covering it wants to talk about it, you know, and I feel like some people have the feeling that, it's just like anywhere else, right? Like some people are like, what is going on? These locals here, like Uber drivers and stuff like that. And some people are like, oh, this is going to be fun, you know? So it's even wildly split here. But it's been a long time since I've been out to DC. So to see something like that is very, it's crazy, right? Near all the monuments and these marmoreal like pillars that are all over the place. And like you're going by and then you see this big structure sitting in front of the White House. It's been pretty cool. But I will say that so far I had to kind of hit the ground running. I had to come in on yesterday morning, Thursday morning, rather than Wednesday night. And I immediately went to the U.S. Department of State, and I saw Dana signing the whatever that is, the MOU with Marco Rubio. And that was an interesting experience. And really, that was my first up close non-political, no, I'm kidding, of course, political, like very political look as to like how people are seeing it, I think. You know what I mean? Like some of the local politicians and some of the local fanfare out here. Very, very strange setup over there, man.
I know you have an article coming out about this.
I think it just went live, as a matter of fact.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. I'll try and get it up here before you go. But are you around MMA media or is it, political media when you're there covering that event? And what's their reaction to all of this?
I believe I was the only MMA person there. I'm not kidding when I say this. Like, it was all local Washington, Bloomberg and CNN. That was like all of that. And then me, who was like, just a stranger in a strange land. It was very different. It was funny to hear because they kind of shuffle you in, which was really funny because they made us ride like a service elevator up to where we're going and through the kitchen with the help and all that stuff through a kitchen.
Like Goodfellas.
And then they set you up just like Goodfellas. But it's funny to hear the takes of media that are not MMA media and how they're talking about it. And, it's clear that they haven't really paid much attention to it until they're forced to. And so there's like this, there's an automatic divide. But we knew that this was going to be a very bizarre thing. But to kind of see that up close and personal and hear the little jokes about cage fighting, like them referring to it as cage fighting and that being a big deal. And, there was one person who was making a joke like, so that's America's diplomacy is like punching people in the face. That's our, they're astonished by this. And like, there was all these jokes going on. I mean, that sort of thing. I'm like, for MMA people, this is kind of gold, So I felt like I included a little bit of that in the piece, just kind of observing the other part of the media that's covering this.
That is weird, right? I mean, I've thought about this as we've gotten closer to this event because I kept waiting for it to really feel like it was ramping up. And I thought, all right, fight week is when it'll happen where people start to go, all right, huge thing happening. And it was slow to happen. And then it seems like kind of all at once, the last day or two, people being like, oh, holy shit, this is actually going to happen. Isn't that weird? Here's the thing that I thought was interesting. I saw a poll out, this from a Reuters article that came out yesterday. And it was basically talking about how there aren't many people willing to profess support for this whole event and the whole idea. It says few Americans, including only a third of Republicans, approve of President Donald Trump's plan to hold mixed martial arts cage matches at the White House on Sunday to celebrate U.S. history. Just 16% of Americans said it was appropriate for Trump to hold the Ultimate Fighting Championship event scheduled for his 80th birthday. Just a coincidence, by the way. While 46% says it was inappropriate.
Was that your parentheses? That was your parentheses.
That was my parentheses, mine. 46% said it was inappropriate, and the rest didn't offer an opinion, which is a big chunk of people who were like asked in this poll, do you think it's appropriate to have this fight on the White House lawn? And they went, I don't know. And, did they go, I don't know, because they hadn't heard about it, because they just weren't like really aware of it? Because that's a big chunk of people for a poll like this. To just be like, I don't have an opinion on this either way, especially since it just sort of reminded me, we've been in the bubble, right? Like we're hardcore in this. We've been hearing about this for almost a literal year. They started talking about it last summer, like last July, where Trump starts to float the idea, right? So we've been hearing about it forever. We've been fantasy matchmaking this thing forever. It's finally here. It feels to us like the eyes of the world are upon it. And yet that is actually not the case when you look at some of this poll numbers. To the other people, I keep wondering, is the information that's filtering down to them just a big WTF? What is this? What is happening?
It's a big part of it. Rubio speculated when he was talking that over a billion people would be tuned in.
Power slap that, numbers. Those are power slap numbers.
Those are power slap numbers. So I just wanted to see what you guys might have thought of that.
That did annoy me. And it annoyed me not for the reasons that you think, right? Because it's annoying, I think, that you go out there and you say, we're expecting over a billion. Well, shit, if we're just expecting stuff, why stop at a billion? Why not 10 billion, man? Why not every man, woman, and child the planet of the Earth plus the population of some other planets are going to tune in to watch this? Like, we're just saying stuff, right? And that I get, we're doing, you know, the entire Trump administration, they love hyperbole, love to just like hype stuff up that fits very well with a fight promoter's mentality, which is always every fight is the biggest one ever. The next one is going to be bigger than that. That all, I guess, is to be expected. But to me, when I hear them come out and be like, no, this entire thing is on Paramount Plus, the entire thing,
right,
exclusive to Paramount Plus, that tells me you're not trying for a billion. You're not trying for a huge record-setting audience. You're trying for Paramount Plus subscriptions. That's what you're trying for. Because it's like, if you were trying for the biggest possible audience, it'd be on CBS and Paramount. Right. You know, you'd put it on every possible platform you could to try to get as many eyes as possible. I also went and looked at what is on CBS on Sunday night.
I was just about to ask.
Hey, maybe they got something big, right? Maybe they got something big. They couldn't move it. Reruns. They got an episode of Marshals, the spinoff from Yellowstone, but it's an old episode that debuted last month. Then they got an episode of Tracker, a new show, but it's still a rerun. Then another episode of Marshals.
No, Landman.
A rerun. Landman. This is some Paramount Plus stuff, BT. Don't get it twisted.
Get your subscription if you really want to watch Landman. Go ahead, Ben.
But you're not even doing anything with CBS that night. Yeah. You're not busy. You've got like a live golf event earlier in the day. This is live sports.
Hang on. So there's no fights on CBS.
No, it does not seem that way. It's all Paramount Plus.
But yeah, that's
Was that not the whole, like, from an outside of America perspective, the only possible way they could have, you know, in theory, when you look at the subscription numbers on Paramount Plus versus Netflix, and the idea that we're all talking about that 17 million, the only way that could have happened based on my conversations with American people was if the fights were on CBS. Is that incorrect?
I mean, Paramount Plus has 79 million subscribers from last we heard. So if every single one of them watched it, you'd do a really good number that falls still, you know, well short of a billion. But not every one of them going to watch it. You are going to pick up some subscribers, I'm sure. But it really does tell you that, like we talked about when we were discussing that Hollywood Reporter article, all the quotes we heard from TKO executives, from Paramount executives, it really seemed to suggest their focus is on what this event can do for Paramount and not what this event can do for the UFC, its popularity, its visibility. That seems like a real missed opportunity to me, because I know, obviously, you align yourself with Trump this heavily. There's going to be backlash to it. There's going to be people who don't like it. There's going to be people who normally would watch your stuff who probably won't watch this one just because they can't stand it. But you were in a good position here to pick up some curiosity viewers, people who just heard that this was happening and they're like, this is weird. I got to see what this is like. And maybe some of those people become your fans. Maybe some of those people decide that they like this sport. You had an opportunity there, and to instead turn it around and make it so that we're just going after the short money. We're just looking for subscribers that we can pick up on the night. That to me is a disappointment. And it just says, like, okay, so we're not thinking about growth of this sport. We're not thinking about like using this as much as they said, like this is a long-term opportunity. They're not really treating it that way. And that I think is frustrating, especially if you're going to then turn around talking about how you think you're going to get a billy. Paramount is like the 7th ranked streaming service. You know?
Yeah.
Like, you're not doing huge numbers on that. It is for now,
wait till Monday.
Wait till the numbers come in. So, Chuck, tell me. Right, so the next 2 days are fairly packed in terms of media schedule. What are you planning to do? What can you do? And do you know where you'll be stationed during the fights?
Well, the UFC hasn't been as accommodating as I was hoping. Now, I'm giving them some.
I blame Ben for that.
That's
because they do have like a huge amount of media here, and obviously this is like legacy media that expands so many different, so many different realms. It's like, even just going to Radio Row, I wanted to go there because they have a Radio Row, which is very Super Bowl, or like Conor versus Mayweather. I was like, I wanted to go there having seen that type of thing and just kind of get the temperature of that, be like, what is this compared to the others? But I can't go in there because they said that it's full. So it's either I'm going to try to crash that party or I won't be allowed in there, PZ. So it's like, this is the kind of things I'm, these are the kinds of things I'm running into out here. But I'm definitely going to be checking out the press conference, which is at the Lincoln Memorial. And this, you know, as much as we're talking about, you know, the Octagon on the West Lawn and attitudes toward that and the polls that Ben is mentioning, this is the one that I most, like, you know, you most want to see the reaction of, like, because you're now at the Lincoln Memorial where so many historic things have taken place and there's such a reverence to this place. And the, you know, you see the pictures of them setting it all up. And it just, this to me is, if you're talking about like something being defiled, this seems like the event that might be the case. A little bit, yeah. I mean, yeah, I think so. I mean, I've heard more people talk about the Lincoln Memorial than I have about the lawn, to be honest. How about you? I mean, Ben, has that been accurate? I mean, I feel like a lot of people are concerned about that.
Well, when I saw that lawsuit that they tried to file to try to preemptively stop this thing, and one of the things I saw noted either in the lawsuit or it was a quote in some story in response to a lawsuit where somebody was like, these are the images that will be in U.S. history textbooks when people look back on this administration, perhaps saying we can't believe the crazy shit that went on. It will be a press conference of, you know, Josh Hokett standing up there doing his bit in front of the Lincoln Memorial, where, you know, Richard Nixon was once confronted by Vietnam protesters in the middle of the night. Right. And now we're out here and we're selling a fight, basically. And that would be held up as a visual shorthand, like an immediate symbol of sort of the corruption of the administration, but also like their willingness to just do whatever, even if it broke all norms and like sense of like historical perspective. And so like, I do think that as a visual will be pretty strong. And I will like, that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about where I'm like, how many people are going to sort of brown in to awareness of this and kind of go, wait a minute. I remember hearing a headline or something, but there's been a lot in the news. You could be forgiven if your attention was taken in other directions and you forgot about the UFC event on the White House lawn. And then you start to see some of that and you go, wait a minute, are we just doing like crass commercialism at historic U.S. political sites? Like, is that what we're doing now? Like, I think that will be kind of shocking to some people. It'll also be, I'll be very interested to hear Chuck's take on it. I was furious too, Chuck. Like, for one thing, when, like, did you have to go, did the credentialing process get more stringent than usual? It wasn't just like, here's a headshot of me, you guys know who the hell I am, give me my credential.
They had you fill out in advance you know, some paperwork before this event even happened, and then we all had to go to the Hotel Washington, and this is the check-in, the hub for people, and they you know, they retake your picture, they go through that process, and then this, the particular credentials, I guess, are different. I mean, like, there are some that get you into any of these pre-event activities that we're talking about. And then there are some, obviously, that have, you know, they have access to the lawn and things like that more so than the general press credential. So it has been vetted at me. But there was when I went in there, it was which was yesterday, there was a pretty big line. It was like 20 people and I didn't recognize a single person. You know, normally if you go into a situation, you know, most of the people. It's just a completely different setup for this thing. I want to find out, like, honestly, one of the questions I have is like, how many people are credentialed in general for this event? You know, like media turnout, because they've talked about that as an unprecedented number as well. So, and separating fact from fiction, like, I knew it would be coming, you know, that would be part of this process. It's just trying to figure out, because I don't know how many people, like, of the people who are like more of the political bent or like they're, you know, Washington, I don't care if they, I mean, I don't know if they care that Dana White, like, we're nitpicking over, like, they didn't even know each other. Donald Trump didn't play a role into, you know, these early UFCs and all that stuff. I mean, if he did, it was just this small role. It wasn't like this major. I just don't get the sense that they care. Like, just in general conversations, that part of it, they just don't care about, which I was like, wow, you guys are browbeaten with these signs of, like, you know, just being told and having to accept that narrative. Very different than we're used to, man.
Do you, what are the towns of bartenders saying, by the way?
What's that?
what are the bartenders of Washington, D.C. saying?
It's important.
That might be later tonight, Ben. You look for my piece tomorrow. We'll see what they have to say.
I'm looking forward. It's an important piece of journalism to ask every time you're on the road.
Go
to.
You want the truth, that's where you go.
Tell me, Chuck, where do you believe you'll be stationed, or does that come at a later time where you'll find out during the fights themselves?
I'm in the media center, and as far as I know, I think it's at the JW Hotel. I honestly don't really know that for a fact, because there's a lot of information like going around, lots of different schedules and all this stuff. But that, from what I understand, that's where it's supposed to be. I even asked that when I checked in at the hotel, the Washington, and they're like, I don't know. I'm not sure where that's at, you know? And I'm like, okay, great. So it's one of those situations. I'm sure that it is all like laid out, but the communication has been a little lacking, I think, so far.
Do you think that's by design? Do you think that there's just like...
Maybe. We didn't even know, like, when did we find out that it's going to be exclusively on Paramount Plus? I feel like
this week.
Yeah. Ben just told me. It's all kind of like this. It's very weird. It's very weird that way.
Are you disappointed with that, Chuck? Because, like, obviously this is a big event. You are like a legend of the coverage of this sport, and you've made your way to Washington, and they won't let you on Radio Row. You don't know where you're going to be sitting really during the fights themselves. Is it a bit of a bummer for you?
How easy they forget, Petey. You know, like doing the heavy lifting.
I will never forget.
Yeah, ESPN. The Ringer would have never talked about this sport if I didn't kind of force it in. And how easy
they forget us. And I'd be unemployed.
Yes. That's right. Yeah, you'd be unemployed. So, like, you know, but sure, there's a little bit of that, because I don't know. But we have to wait and see, because I don't know. They keep saying limited seats and everything's so vague. Well, limited seats just kind of push you away and all this stuff. But, you know, come fight night when we find out exactly who was credentialed under the West Lawn and all that stuff, then maybe I'll have my gripes. But there's a possibility that there's very few people on that lawn when it comes down to it.
In terms of the media, anyway.
Yeah.
Is this, like, I think this would be easy, like, is this the most unique MMA event you've ever covered?
Definitely. I mean, I was at the Sphere card, and I mean, that's just a venue though, right? Everything else was pretty much normal. Like, you might have had a few gawkers and, you know, from outside world kind of coming in, like, what's this about? But generally speaking, that was still a very MMA-centric thing. This one feels to me very different. Like, it almost feels like it's incidental that there's an MMA card attached to this, like that there's actual fighters and all that stuff. That's so far, I haven't really even come into contact with, you know, just the general fight game public, like, you know, the managers, the coaches, stuff. You run into them all the time, but so far that has not even happened. Maybe that changes over the next couple of days, but this is very, very different setup than the.
I mean, hasn't that been the feel for the last couple of weeks, where I keep waiting for the focus to shift to the fighters more? And so far, the only way I've seen it happen is this beef between Ilya Topuria and Justin Gaethje, as it starts to get a little more personal. Those guys have honestly done more to sell the actual fighting on this card than anybody else, including the UFC. Like, just that angle popping up pretty organically, it seems, that has been one of the few things that has brought attention to the individual fighters. In the negative way, there's been Josh Hokett trying to do a bit that's just not landing at all, and making the mistake of acknowledging that the bit is not landing and just sort of being like, well, nobody's liking this, I'm going to do it anyway. You know, few moments, those are kind of the only thing I've seen that get people paying attention to the fighters. Every other regard, it's kind of, the thing that feels a little gross to me about it is that it just feels like the fighters are hired help. It feels like they might as well be the caterers. It feels like they're a wedding band or something where, hey, we're having this event. We need to have some entertainment. That's sort of what we're doing.
So true.
But you guys aren't the point. The point is us. The point is us. And this is the thing that came up when I was doing my story, talking to some historians for a little while.
I was just going to point this out. Yeah.
Because so many people were making this comparison. Are these gladiator games for the entertainment of the emperor on his birthday? And talking to them, and they, you know, there's a lot of differences. There's not a one-to-one comparison, obviously. But one of the things that Patrick Wyman pointed out to me was basically that this is essentially a celebration of elites for other elites that happens to have a public consumption angle. It's basically like showing off, hey, we can do this big event on the White House. All these VIPs are going to be invited. You guys can watch too if you're willing to pay the subscription price for Paramount Plus. But it doesn't feel, at least so far, like the fighters are the focus at all. And that would be really disappointing to me if I was one of those fighters. We got guys fighting for titles out here, and they feel like an afterthought.
Yeah. You will. Chuck, I know you have only a certain amount of time with us. Do you have time to go through your picks with us
for
this event? Or okay.
Yes.
Well,
I've
got
time.
Our picks. And, you know, let's just have a look at the table there. I believe Is that, who's that up the top again now again? It's,
oh jeez, I can't see that. That's,
it's Ben, folks.
I can see it. Yeah. I see it just fine.
Maybe we've got Eric Jackman
in second place, Chuck Mendenhall chasing it up there in third. Then it's Petey Carroll. Then it's Mysterious Frank, Drake Riggs, Sheen Al-Shaadi. And at the very bottom there, Connor Brooks, mind you, only two positive picks away from myself. We're all on Taporia. The two people on GAN are Ben Folks, interestingly, Drake Riggs, all on O'Malley, all on Hokit, all but one of us on Hoofy. Yeah, Drake Riggs has gone for Chandler. Interesting.
What?
All of us on Nickel. And here, I'm actually quite excited about this. A few people, I thought I was being bold by picking Garcia because I was inspired by his performance on the Ariel Wani interview. And yeah, it's kind of split. We've got Folks has gone for Lopez. Chuck has gone for Lopez. I have gone for Garcia. Very, very interesting, boys.
I went back and forth on that one. I gotta be honest. That was the hardest one to pick for me.
That one has my pick for fight of the night. Like the most competitive and like some of the best action I think you're likely to get. You very well have that one being the best, most exciting fight of the night.
Look at this. Kalshi has got some news for us here, boys. Who are the people trading here on Kalshi? Garcia, 42% against Lopez, 48%.
It's crazy? Narrowing, though. You see it narrowing.
Yeah, it is narrowing. It was a lot worse. You can see that earlier to the left-hand side of this picture here. Like it felt a lot further out early on. But I think Garcia is a savage, man.
He's a
violent, violent dude.
I think a lot of what you see there in that graph is Diego Lopez has more name recognition with more people. And that, you know, when he looks good, he looks really, really good. And when you see him against, you know, it's like, okay, he couldn't figure out Alexander Volkanovski, but he's in some pretty good company there. You know, it's not exactly a knock on the guy. But the one to me, I'm surprised that I was one of only two people to pick Gon. I think that one is a lot tougher to pick than maybe we assume.
You're tough too.
We love Alex Pereira. Everybody in the sport is very excited about Alex Pereira. Yeah.
Look at that market, boys. That is right there. That is 50-50 right now. Am I seeing that right? It is, isn't it? My God.
I mean, yeah. I could absolutely see Alex Pereira going out there and winning, but I could also see Ciryl Gane knocking him out or something. And when we all go, well, hey, yeah, he's never fought a heavyweight. We have these weight classes for a reason.
I can see this.
He's been knocked out before. He's never dealt with heavyweight power before. Plus, didn't Ciryl Gane look pretty good in that Tom Aspinall fight up until the eye poke stopped it? Plus, stylistic matchup-wise, isn't this exactly the kind of fighter Gane would like to go against? He doesn't want to go up against anybody who might take him down, but these are the kinds of matchups he tends to do well in. I could absolutely see it either way, but that's one where I just kind of went, you know what? Yeah. One of these guys, I've seen him at heavyweight, and the other one, I haven't.
If it happens, Ben, only a couple of us can say, like, hey, we tried to tell you, right? A couple of us could do that. I'm in Washington. I could start to obscure the facts around here a little bit. You know what I'm talking
about? I was actually wrong. Connor Brooks is going for Dawkins. He is the solo going for Mr. Dawkins against Bo Nickel. I'm a bit shocked.
He's trying to make a move here. He wants a bunch of upsets so that he can make his move up up the standings.
I would love to know what method of victory he sees for Dawkins in this fight.
Punching.
Disqualification.
But it is interesting, going back to the Pereira thing, I spoke to a guy who fought Ciryl Gane earlier this week, and he was kind of, obviously he's never fought Pereira.
John Jones? Was it John Jones?
Listen, I can't say. But I think everyone
John
that's
told me not
my
to
face
say anything.
Knows it's John Jones. It's not John Jones. But he was saying, like, he is so fast, you know? Like, and if you're in there with him for like 25 minutes, and you can't hit him. And let's not forget, Ngannou did not knock this guy out. You know, like Alex Pereira is coming up from 205, was the middleweight champion. Ngannou couldn't knock this dude out. Tom Aspinall couldn't knock this dude out. He does something really, really well. He is so elusive and big at the same time. And when he needs to, he can hit very hard. Now, he did get chin checked by Tai Tuivasa in France. Very briefly. There was this moment where we're like, I cannot believe this might happen. Of course, it did not happen. But Pereira's put on so much weight. You know, like what did he come in at? 258 for the... He is going to feel so different in there than he usually feels.
And right, I know but he'll feel so different to himself as well, right?
Yes.
I mean, putting on all that weight is basically putting yourself into a new body. And this is going to be your first time fighting in that new body. And so that... I really often don't like it when you see a guy who shows up and he has a completely different physique that he doesn't necessarily know how to perform. Remember when John Jones became a power lifter there for a while? And, you know, he still won. But remember we had the hot mic moment after, what was it? Was it the Ovince St. Preux fight maybe? Yes. Where afterwards we could hear his corner being like, the powerlifting was a mistake. You know, like it's just like,
that's right.
It's tough when you show up and like your own physique is way different. And I could see thinking, all right, I need to bulk up to be able to go in there and deal with a heavyweight size. But that sometimes backfires on people.
Yeah, it's a lot. Like, and the fact that Gann is so used to going those 25 minutes and so used to just be standing up, evading people for that long, and Pereira having to be using this new output with such a heavier body, it is definitely interesting. And I heard Rick saying it yesterday and Boys in the Back. Like, I was very confident of Pereira at the start of the week. As the week goes on, I find myself having conversations with myself like, oh, this could go pretty badly, actually. This could go very wrong for Pereira. And usually when we're setting someone up for these historical moments, that's when it tends to happen.
Yeah, that is true.
Is Hokit the biggest, like, the clearest win for you guys on this card? Like, I feel like that could be an annihilation.
The question for me is, how does he go about fighting Derek Lewis? Because there's the way people will want you to fight Derek Lewis, the kind of fight you know people want to see out of you at the White House on this big stage after the Curtis Blaydes fight. And then there's what would be smart for Hokit against Derek Lewis. And those are not the same things. And so I do wonder, if you stand there and try to give people what they want, that's the best chance Derek Lewis has. I also wonder, with Derek Lewis, especially at this point in his career, you never know if he'll just get to a point in the fight, if things aren't going his way, if he'll just sort of get that look on his face where he's like, I want to go home. I would rather be elsewhere. You know, he's done that.
He has. And there's been a couple of times where he's done it where he's faking it too, like against Volkov, where he's like, I'm done. And then he like blasts you with a big shot at the end. But I mean, honestly, his biggest thing is, if Hokit doesn't protect himself a little better, it's not impossible to imagine where he just, you know, Hokit just takes a shot that downs him. I mean, if he goes in there too aggressive or too reckless, I mean, that could be his downfall in this fight.
It's also, Lewis gets up so quickly when he's taken down. You know, I know he probably hasn't been dealing with the standard of athlete that Hokit is, but he does tend to just cumbersomely get back to his feet somehow when he's taken down. And I just like imagining this is like, he just keeps standing up against Hokit and Hokit doesn't want to exchange. It, for all of its bluster, it could actually turn into one of those heavyweight fights that Ben Folks often references on this show, the ones where you lose the will to live when you realize we're entering the second round and I don't see a finish coming out here soon.
That's what I like to call the other kind of heavyweight fight. There's the fun kind that ends inside of one round, and then there's the other kind. Josh Hokit was in the rarest of heavyweight fights, the kind that goes the distance but is still somehow fun. And I do wonder how the pressure of people wanting to see him repeat that, especially the pressure of this moment, could affect how he chooses to fight Derek Lewis. Because there's also one thing, we've seen guys before in some of these big kind of fights when they're really riding a high and a momentum, and they have a great game plan coming in. They worked with it on their coaches. Hey, we talked about this in the back. We know what we're going to do. And then you get in there, you get under the lights, you start to feel it, and that game plan goes right out the window, and you start doing the thing you didn't do just to entertain people or give people what you think they want. And Derek Lewis is the kind of guy that could go terribly against.
Should we be worried, Chuck, about Drake Riggs picking Michael Chandler here? Like, the pick king, the king of the picks, Drake Riggs. Can we do a wellness check? Like, Chandler against Hoofy. I mean, I was speaking about annihilations. Maybe I got ahead of myself. I think this is, well, there we go.
Same here.
Only 18% of people on Kalshi are trading for Chandler. My God. Yeah.
Well, Chandler, like, he has the one victory against Tony Ferguson at the time was already kind of well on his downswing. And that was, what, 4 years ago. So it's like, I mean, if you kind of do this math, you're like, I feel bad for Chandler because, you know, like, things were supposed to go different for him down the stretch. And here he is now going up against this young, what is he, 28 years old? The dude is like just a marauder in there. I mean, he's going in there against this guy. I'm like, this is not the get well fight that you want, right? This is not a good matchup in my mind.
He's still calling out Conor McGregor. I saw the headlines this week. I'm like, dude, you are fighting someone else, mate. And he's fucking terrifying.
I'm telling you right now, one of these days, if any of us are still alive, you'll go to Michael Chandler's funeral somebody will get up there and read a eulogy, and they'll say, and he did ask me to say he will still fight Conor McGregor right now. Where's the Irishman? Get him in here. I want him right now. Like, he's never going to give that up at this point. No. At this point, I just wonder how in on the bit is he? Is he aware that this is a...
He is, dude. I wish he was, man. Like, you know, I really fucking wish he was in on the bit. I don't think he is. Chuck, we have two more, if you can stay with us. Anyone else surprised that no one has gone for Ayman Zahabi? Because I think that's a closer fight than people think it is. Like, every one of us is...
Yeah, I thought somebody would pick him for sure.
Of course, I didn't pick him. I should point that out. I myself did not pick him, but I don't know.
It seems tailor-made in a strange way, though, for O'Malley here, right? Like, Zahabi got clipped a couple times and his last fight's dropped. And I'm like, I don't think he comes back from that type of thing if he gets truly in trouble against O'Malley, who likes to strike. I mean, I feel like maybe it's a little bit like geared towards O'Malley here and, you know, stand up and that will favor him, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I do think you're right, PT, that it is closer than people are acting like it is. But I think O'Malley's a big fight performer. He's a big sort of moment guy. Plus, even if I thought that Zahabi was going to win, I'm not going to pick against hell on his own Sean O'Malley.
Yeah, that's fair. Chuck, before you go, Topuria obviously in a massive spot here. The lads brought up a good point yesterday that it almost feels like he surpassed Pereira in terms of the draw, in terms of the stardom ahead of this card. And maybe that's lending itself. Maybe that's borrowed from the fact he's having this back and forth that Ben referenced earlier with Justin Gaethje. I feel like... as much as I commend them for doing that, Ben, as you did, I do feel like they're just kind of juicing it up a bit. I don't really feel like these guys really give a fuck that much. But it is a talking point. It is a sell.
But you don't think Chopera is out there, I'm going to knock you out in front of your country and I'm going to go over and talk to your dad. Like, that's... If Justin Gaethje didn't care...
That's just like walking in the park kind of deal.
Before that, he cares now. Especially that he's created that image for him. Like, your father and nation... will watch you get put to sleep. You don't want that. That's embarrassing, bro.
You imagine, like, Ilya's kind of shuffling over towards his father and there's Justin, like, crawling along the canvas going, no! You leave my dad alone!
Speak to him! It is weird, though, that the thing he says he's going to say to Justin's father is, who's the short one now? Bro, you'll still be the same height. I love Ilya Topuria. I think he's a beautiful martial artist and everything, but you are actually short in the world, bro. Like, that's... Yeah. And it's not going to make you any taller. I think you will be Justin Gaethje, but you're still going to be the exact same height afterwards. So I don't know if that's what we want to focus on.
And we still got like time because it's being a Sunday show. Like he still might ratchet it up. And the great thing about him is he has backed everything up so far.
Yeah. Right?
Like every time he says he's going to do this, he does it. That's why if he emerges as like a bigger star, it's going to be because he did the same thing where he drew it in, said he was going to do it, and then he does it in some dramatic way, and then you're like, okay, this dude just keeps doing this against, you know what I mean? Like, that's going to be the distinguishing factor. You mentioned him being short, but his stature seems to grow by fight night. It always seems like by the time it gets there, it feels like a big deal.
That's what Customato used to say about...
Once he puts on the little hat, he gets way bigger.
You know, Customato used to say that to journalists when they used to come and watch Mike Tyson sparring. They used to walk in and they'd be like, where's the heavyweight? And they like point at this 5'10" guy in the ring.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, wow, he's very small. And Cus would say to them, oh, don't worry, he expands. that's kind of like how I feel about Ilya.
That is true.
Do you see him becoming the main man? Like if he's not already, like, do you see this him hitting a new stratosphere if all goes according to plan here on the South Lawn, Chuck?
I've been real torn on this because I'm one of those guys who's like, we call him a star, but we've also seen what a real star looks like. I don't know if he'll ever be that. It's one of those things that I'm like, maybe it's just an unfair bar, but I do think that in terms of where we're at in the UFC, if you kind of, and we will find out in a few weeks, right, with like where Conor stands in this whole thing, but I think he's got a chance to be the guy for now, like the guy who we'll pay attention to, like in Liddell's day or something like that, or George St. Pierre. Like it would be more in that strata, but I think he can do that because if he's not there already, only because of what I said, I feel like he rises to the moment, the escalation, he seems to handle it, he seems tailor-made for a spotlight, and he puts on his best performances. This would certainly be, just given the setup of this, if he goes in there and does it and makes it look easy, I mean, in this environment, like this kind of thing, I think that that's going to go over pretty big.
Well, Chuck, you have given us way more time than we said we wanted. We love you very much.
I got my very much housekeepers here. All right, we'll be there in a minute.
I'm looking forward to everything you're going to do over there, even if you don't get the access we think you deserve. But thanks so much for joining us, my friend.
Of course, fellas.
Be reading you all week. All the best,
man. All right. See you guys.
Ah, now it's just back to me and Benjamin. Are you Chris and Benjamin, folks?
Yeah, we don't need to talk about it, but yeah.
What? I mean, it's a powerful name.
All right, Peter. Yeah. That's just fine. That's fine.
Well, my mom calls me Petey.
Okay. That's...
Elaine will call me
You're a Peter. Grown man. You're a grown man.
Yeah. And everyone else calls me Petey. You know what I mean? Why is it that your missus won't accept your nickname? You know, boy, she met me, my name was... Everyone called me Petey, and then just as soon as the commitment gets going, Peter. You know what I mean? What is that?
She has to set aside. She has to just show people that she has a different relationship with you than the rest of them. That they can call you Petey.
I'd like her to create a different nickname.
It's not about you. It's very much not about you. It's a signal to the world.
Oh, Jesus. I didn't think about it on those terms. Ben, you have one thing that everybody has been talking about, in fact, and even Chuck kind of mentioned there, is the security for this event. The many hoops people have to jump through to get here. The fact that we will have the President of the United States, which you point out in your latest article for Uncrowned. This man had an attempt on his life 7 weeks ago. I don't know how you did this. I was looking at this and I was like, how many fucking people does this guy have in his phone book? Just casually call up some Secret Service members and ask them, what scale of security detail will be on the White House South lawn? Talk me through this article. I don't know if you're allowed to tell me how you got to these people, but how long did it take you to get in touch with these people?
Took a little while, but you know what? One thing I've learned as a journalist is that you never know. If you reach out and you ask, people might be more willing to talk than you think. And you go around, you collect some names, people who seem like they might know something about it. And then a lot of times they're more willing to talk. Especially one of the things that's surprising when you get used to being a journalist in fight sports, where seemingly no one wants to talk to you, even when they have to. Even when somebody is making them talk to you, a lot of times when they actually sit down to talk, you're like, oh, they'd rather cut off a toe than have this conversation right now. And so you're just dead and trying to get useful stuff out of them. Other people... as it turns out, do enjoy talking about their areas of expertise and the areas that they have experience in. And so once you get them on the phone, you know, it's not that hard. And if you just, one of my favorite things being a journalist just in general is that you never know what you're going to end up learning that you didn't think would ever come up in your normal course of business. And if you just kind of keep an open mind and stay curious, then you might hear some stuff. And I love like just learning different people's worlds and different things that they know, and talking to especially like former Secret Service agent, former special forces people about this. One of the things I came away surprised by a little bit is that when I first heard the idea for this event, where I was just like, you're telling me, and this is before the most recent attempt on the president, but it was like there had already been several. We were already engaged in a war with Iran, which I remember at the time people were like, oh, don't worry, it'll be over by the time we get to this. It's not over. No matter what we get told every day, it's almost over, but it's as of now, not over. All this stuff, tensions are high, there's a lot going on. And you're going to have the President of the United States sit outside on his lawn for a period of at least a couple hours, you would have to think, at a pre-announced date that gives anybody who might be looking to do something lots of time to prepare and plan. And I was like, that seems risky, man. Like that, especially with tensions as high as they are, that seems tricky. We've just been told we need to spend $100 billion or whatever it is on a ballroom. No, it's like a billion. But still, we need to spend all this money on a ballroom because of security concerns. And then you're going to go sit out on the White House lawn. It seemed like, man, the Secret Service has got to be pretty nervous about that. And then when I talked to these people, they were like, you know, honestly, this is the one place where they probably feel the best about doing it. They're probably not that worried about the outdoor nature of it as long as it's at the White House. If you were doing it at Yankee Stadium, then, you know, you need to go in well in advance. You need to map out all your security plans. But if you're doing it at the White House, that's the area they know best. That's where they work every single day. That's, as one guy pointed out, the most controlled airspace in the country is over the White House. And so that's the area that is essentially their home field. They feel pretty good there. And as when I brought up, well, hey, this has been known for a long time, you know exactly when and where he's going to be. And he says, well, the president's whereabouts are not usually much of a mystery. People generally know where the president is. So that they didn't seem concerned about. The thing that obviously is the big concern and is going to be the big concern for just sort of any big outdoor event from now until the foreseeable future is drones. And all kinds of different drones, like the
agricultural drones.
Yeah. Well, what they referred to first as nuisance drones, which just somebody putting a drone up there, just seeing what they can see with it, seeing if they can disrupt the event, and just out of curiosity and chaos trying to do something. But then also, Sky pointed up all these stolen agricultural drones that had 40-gallon tanks that were stolen in New Jersey pretty recently, and they got them back. But he's like, you know, imagine what you could do if you had 15 agricultural drones that could carry 40-gallon payload tanks and what you could put in there, the kind of damage you could cause if all you wanted to do was just wreak havoc. And that kind of stuff, you realize, okay, that is a concern. They have to be constantly monitoring the skies. They have to be on top of all of that. But also just that you're doing this event at the White House and then across the street, you've got all these people at the Ellipse where there's going to be a huge crowd, you think, there. So it's just a massive humanity. And then on the other place, a much smaller crowd that you really are tightly controlling the access to, but also a lot of VIPs, a lot of, you know, what somebody would regard as high value targets. So there's a lot of pressure and stress on them for sure. But also, if they have to do it anywhere, they probably feel most comfortable doing it at the White House. And as one of them pointed out, he's like, isn't it better for everybody else if they do it at the White House? Because you saw what had to happen for Trump to go to a game at Madison Square Garden earlier this week. They closed off an entire section of Midtown so that he could go do it. You're closing off streets for the motorcade to get there and get out. You're snarling traffic. You're creating a lot of inconvenience for everybody. You had to cancel watch parties outside the arena. A lot of like headaches for the people around there. Whereas if he's staying home at the White House, I'm sure there's some Washington, D.C. residents who are still like, we don't love it when all these people are coming to town and it creates a traffic situation, but it's less disruptive than it would be if he left the White House to go somewhere else for this.
Yeah, it's a great point. And that coupled with the elite politics piece, you read them and it kind of does bring home the point that it doesn't feel like it's for us. You know, as you've said before, like this doesn't feel like it's for the diehard MMA fan, the UFC fan that's been there since the start, waiting for it to get to this magical peak moment. It just doesn't. The fact that it's on the way, like, look, listen to Chuck. Like, Chuck's not gonna. It doesn't sound like Chuck's gonna have a view of the fights. Like that. That's pretty crazy in itself, right? Or am I being a bit too touchy about that?
Yeah. No. I mean, it's not as if it's the only time the UFC has done this where media will be put in a place that they're essentially watching it on TV. The difference is that usually you're watching it on TV somewhere where they will bring the fighters to you
after the fight.
So that you can talk to them. So you still are getting like a media angle out of it. I wonder if that will be the case here, if they have you at like an offsite hotel. It also then becomes, okay, so I came in for the event week stuff, for the pre-fight stuff. Who knows where we'll do a press conference. Maybe they'll do it at the whatever the hotel is where they have people. So I don't know. I do think that there's still some interesting stuff that you can get out of it, but it is a very different viewing experience. I also think that it's worth noting. I mean, one of the big things that we paid attention to beforehand is this being an outdoor event, and there's just so many variables that go in to an outdoor event, you know, where we don't know exactly what the weather's going to be. I'm sure that the UFC, like Dana White, has said, hey, we're going no matter what. If there's lightning, we'll take a lightning delay. You know, you look at that thing, you're covered for some rain, unless it starts blowing in sideways. Lightning could definitely be a problem with something like that. You've essentially created a giant lightning rod, maybe. But yeah, it could be disruptive weather-wise. We've heard Dana White talk about the bugs and just all the different stuff that can go on. And I worked on a story, it should be out here pretty soon, about outdoor events. And one of the things that brought up to mind was Fan Man. Do you remember Fan Man?
No, you're going to have to refresh my memory.
You don't. Do not know. You might be, you youngster, you don't remember. In the 90s, I believe it was 1993, Evander Holyfield and Riddick Bowe fought for the heavyweight title at Caesar's Palace at an outdoor...
Oh, this guy come down from the fucking...
He came down. Yeah, okay.
He parachuted down with a big like fan motor on his back to like guide him, and just in the early in the seventh round, just sort of landed like on the edge of the ring, got his parachute hung up in the lights, and then got yanked down and was beaten pretty badly by Riddick Bowe's entourage and some security guards and stuff. And that same guy, like that was his thing for a little while. Like I think it was only a few months later he did the same thing without landing, but like above an NFL playoff game. And then right after that, he did it at an FA Cup match in England. And then right after that, he was arrested for that one in England. And then right after that, he landed on the roof of Buckingham Palace.
God damn.
And was banned for life from the United Kingdom. Could never again return. And also, it's like when you kind of look into his story, he died in 2002. You kind of look into his story and you're like, why was he doing this?
What was the motivation? Well,
yeah.
What was?
And the motivation just entirely seemed to be because he could, to see if he could, to get people to look at him, to like just show that like, yeah, you've got these carefully planned events, but I could still disrupt them by doing something like this. And so it's like something to think about when you're doing this event. You plan for all these kind of variables. You're thinking about terrorist attacks. You're thinking about assassination attempts. And you also, on top of that,
If a guy tried to do that at this White House event, I don't think he's alive by the time he hits the ground.
I don't think he is either. Not taking that chance that he's just.
If anyone's thinking about it, this is me and Ben telling you, don't do it.
It's a bad idea.
Very, very tight with the airspace there, as we've pointed out. Do not do that. Very bad idea.
So. I also talked to a few people about who have promoted outdoor events before. And one of my favorites to talk to here on this one was Monty Cox, who, you know, he managed so many fighters in the early days of the UFC, managed a lot of those Miletic guys. And he also promoted a lot of fights in Iowa and in the Midwest. And he did quite a few outdoor events. And he was talking about, you know, you may not know this, Beatsy, but in Iowa, even in the summertime, you're dealing with some unpredictable weather conditions, a thunderstorm, a bad one.
Is that why Slipknot are so upset all the time?
That's probably it. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is unpredictable weather. But like rain and stuff could always be an issue. It always just could roll in and mess things up for you. And he had a couple situations that he had to deal with. My favorite one, he said, was he was promoting one at a casino in Wisconsin, and it was starting to rain before the main event, and it started to get slippery out there. You know, people don't realize, because they see you play soccer in the rain, they see you play football in the rain. As soon as it starts to rain at a fight on that canvas, it's going to get so slippery and it's going to change what is even possible to do in a fight. The entire fight just becomes a mess very quickly. It doesn't take that much rain. And it was starting to rain a little bit. And he said he went back and he told his main event fighters, like, hey, look, I'll let you guys go for one round if you want to and see if you can get a knockout, get a submission, and it'll count. But we're going to call it after one round if nobody has won, and we'll say it's a no contest because it's just getting bad out there. But then he was worried about how he was going to sell it to the crowd because they came here to see this main event. They've been sitting in what is rain already waiting to see this main event, and you're going to go out there and tell them. And so he said the way he did it was by manipulating them a little bit. He went out and told the crowd, look, I talked to the athletic commission. They say it's unsafe to continue. And the people start booing. And he's like, it was bullshit. There was no athletic commission. We were at a casino in Wisconsin, like, you know, in the 90s. Nobody's telling you what you can or can't do. You can do anything. And he said, you know what? But then I went and I told the fighters what the athletic commission said. And they said, that's bullshit. We're fighting. And, you know, huge, huge crowd pop. They love it. They eat it up. They're like, yeah, let's go. And so then the guys come out and fight for a round. Neither one of them knocks the other guy out or submits him. So Monty calls it after a round and says, all right, it's getting too bad out here. And he's like, by then the crowd wasn't too mad because they felt like they'd gotten something that they weren't supposed to get. Plus, they themselves were getting kind of sick of sitting in the rain. And so they're ready to go inside. And it worked. It worked on everybody.
Man, that could be a disaster. Does that, is it the Rumble on the Rock, the Hawaiian events back in the day when that rained out and like the cage is nearly tilting and the guys are just slipping? Every time someone tries to throw a big punch, the weight that they're putting, the leg that they're putting all their weight in just skites across the floor. It looks like two drunk dudes fighting when you throw water in the mix.
I talked to Rich Chow about it because he was involved in promoting some events in Hawaii and then did some of those Bellator events that they did at NASCAR races and stuff where they did them out in. Not only outside, like this is one thing the UFC will have going for it is theirs will mostly take place in the evening. So it should be starting to cool off by then. The heat shouldn't be such an issue. But when they were doing theirs out there in the sun and the canvas is heating up to the point where like it's hurting the bottoms of your feet to walk around on it. And they had to walk around, keep pouring water on the canvas to keep it cool. But he was also talking about, you know, promoting those events in Hawaii, and you'd wake up the morning of the event and it's raining. You know, it'll rain a little bit every day in Hawaii. You never know what you're dealing with. And he was just like, you know, back then though, when you're young and you just want to do something that hasn't been done, you just want to put on a show, it's way easier to focus on all the reasons to do it and not the reasons not to do it. And it tells you something though about how Dana White was, I don't say pressured, but motivated to do this one when Trump asked him to, just because he would never do an outdoor event otherwise if he didn't have to. Anytime it's come up where somebody would be like, how about this? How about this stadium? You could do a big show here. And he doesn't want to do it because he doesn't want to do outdoor events. That the fact that he's willing to break his own policy against outdoor events for this one kind of tells you something.
Yeah, there's so many variables that are at play here that we'll all be looking out for on Sunday.
The most historic sporting event of all time is how they build that. Do you see that?
Greatest show on earth. The greatest show on earth. That's what Donald Trump said.
That is historic. Could mean a lot of things, you know? It's not necessarily good.
Every time I've heard this mentioned on like a different, like not in the MMA orbit, like to your point at the start of the show, it's kind of like a punchline. It's always a gag. And I noticed you wrote for your Substack this week, because I started feeling this way and I saw the article pop up again. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm there now. Where you're like, you're starting to become defensive of the sport.
Yeah.
Like no matter how you feel about the White House event, you're like, this is becoming like, oh, of course that's the sport, you know, that blah, blah, blah. Like, look at this. This is, of course, this shit sport. And you're like, hang on a second, you motherfucker.
Yeah.
Okay. Like,
we didn't say this stuff. We know this world. We've been in it for years and years and years. We can make fun of our drunk uncle. You can't make fun of our drunk uncle. You don't even know. But you're right
as we get closer, it's stirring up. Like, I feel like every day someone texts me being like, oh, fuck this and fuck. And I'm like, all right, man. But, you know, you used to love this too, dickhead. You know, like, what happened to you? You know what I mean? I'm getting very I've had a few fights today. I'm not going to lie to you. Not this stuff.
It made me wonder if the reaction and just sort of the phrasing of some of those reactions would have been different if it had been a boxing match. If he said, okay, they're having a boxing match at the White House. I still think there would have been.
Have one?
No, I don't believe so.
So this is the first of its kind. Okay, fair enough. Sorry.
You think FDR during the Depression is out here being like, we need to make sure the banks can't close and keep your money. And also, let's see if we can get Joe Louis in here or something and get him to put on a fight. But like I wonder if people would have been able to say like it's a boxing match, they still wouldn't have loved it. A lot of people, they still would have felt that it was crass or it was not the place for doing that. But boxing is in their minds as like a historic sport that's been around forever and that is sort of revered, even if it's not their own personal thing. It doesn't feel as like people seem to have a trashy association with the UFC. Like, oh, these are just guys fighting in the parking lot of a Buffalo Wild Wings because they're drunk or something, you know? And I don't know if they would have had that same association if it had been a boxing match. But you're right. Like when you hear people sort of dismiss it that way, because it's like, oh, of course you're doing this dumb sport in for this dumb event. And you're just like, hold on a second.
Yeah.
This is a great sport when it's great.
Isn't it crazy that like that's where we were like two decades ago, and the journey like that we've been on? And look, the sport was nowhere near as popular as it was. Not going to these arenas, it was not the topic of conversations in barbershops around the world, which this event will be. And somehow we're back there, but at this pinnacle as well in terms of exposure, you'd imagine. Isn't that crazy? Like how like 10 years ago the whole drive of the company was to make it line up with the NFL and everything. And I think it did, to some extent, kind of give it some level of prestige or general acceptance. And now suddenly we're back there, even though this is a huge event. Like, you know, this is going to be a massive deal. It's kind of crazy to me. You know what I mean?
It is kind of crazy, but I also think that one of the parts we kind of can't separate from this, when I was talking to Patrick Wyman, I talked to also like a historian who specializes in the history of Roman gladiators, and him kind of talking about the parallels of this head of that. But Pat Wyman pointed out, this was not necessarily where the UFC had to go. This wasn't inevitable. they made some choices along the way to get to right here. And they've made some choices around 2016 and then again around 2020, where they chose to ally stronger and stronger with Donald Trump. And that's how you end up here. It's how no other president is going to even get this idea and carry off this idea. The things people say about Trump that he'll just say, why don't we do this? And it doesn't matter if it's never been done or there's a bunch of people saying there's a million good reasons why he shouldn't. If he gets it in his head, he'll do it. And I think that you see that it has the ability to pull off something like this. It also has the ability to do other very destructive things. But I think that the tricky thing for the UFC is that you have very clearly a visually evident to absolutely everybody, whether they know anything else about your sport or your company or not, you've chosen a side. And you've chosen a side in what is a deeply polarizing political moment in America, and one where more and more there's more people on the other side. And that association is going to stick to you a little. And the UFC really tried for many years not to do anything like this. They didn't want, they'd give money to anybody. They'd give money to Harry Reid. They'd give money to Democrats in the state house in New York, if that's what it took to grease the wheels and get MMA regulated there. They did not have a political association. They were, their only motivation was the UFC, was self-interest, like, let's push this sport. And now they've changed from that. Now they're very clearly in the Donald Trump camp, and that's inevitably going to piss off the people who aren't. And that is part, that's probably going to follow you around for a while after this event.
Yeah, that is the big concern. All right, there's no doubt about that. We will have so much to say about this event in the aftermath. Of course, there will be watch-alongs, there will be post-shows, all of that good stuff. There's still a lot of shit just to happen in terms of press conference, weigh-in, everything like that. But we do have to move on. There is other things that are happening, including the New York Times putting out an article about Conor McGregor confirming that he used banned substances after his horrific leg break in 2021. And I shared this out, and the reaction from the MMA community is like, yeah, we knew that. And we did. Like, McGregor, in his exchange with Anthony Smith, while this was going on, pretty much admitted, he's like, this is all above board, all this stuff. But it's very interesting listening to the doctor in this case, Neil Trash, I believe his name is, the celebrity doctor with the Rams and Dodgers, I believe, has done celebrities, surgeries, all this kind of stuff. Like, him just kind of being very transparent about, like, oh, he couldn't do this, so I had to send it to these guys so he'd get this serious gear. I feel like MMA fans have kind of brushed it under the carpet, to be honest, but like, this is a massive spot to be talking about the biggest star in the history of the sport ahead of what they're calling the biggest event in the history of sports. If nothing else, like, that feels to me like a pretty big moment for them. Did you read this first of all, Ben, and what jumped out to you, if you did?
Well, one of the things that jumped out to me was just the reporting wise, this is a tricky one. This is tricky to get because you have to essentially get people who are on the inside to tell you about a guy's medical treatments, which they probably shouldn't be doing, and they know they shouldn't be doing. I did think it was interesting. Audie Attar, Conor McGregor's manager, had his statement in this, said, you know, it was an unconscionable, like, breach of medical privacy that people are telling you this, which also doesn't sound like, no, that's not true, we didn't do any of that stuff. You know,
Hunter Campbell had a similar line, I believe, in the article.
But I also see, like, I mean, it's kind of like when Barry Bonds got caught, you could be like, how dare they get into this man's private medical history? But you're like, yeah, you kind of do forfeit the right when you are seen as being, like, cheating. Now, the difference is with Conor McGregor, he was doing this while not competing. And so he wasn't actually, in that sense, cheating anybody. He wasn't going in there to fight somebody while using this stuff. Now, the other part of it is we all watched him get bigger. You know, you were recovering from a broken leg.
Massive.
And yet suddenly your delts are popping out and we're going, that has nothing to do with your leg, my man. That is something else.
Do you remember around the Roadhouse filming how big he fucking got? Like, he was like, it was mental. He looked swole. Like, he was all the time. It looked like he was screaming the PEDs out of his body every time he opened his mouth, man. He was ready to explode.
The interesting part to me is this sort of, like, philosophical conversation they're having at some point in this article, where the McGregor camp, doctors, the UFC itself, even, like, some of those comments from, like, Jeff Nowitzki being like, hey, if a guy is recovering from a really serious injury that could affect the rest of his life, not to mention the rest of his career, maybe we shouldn't be holding him to the most stringent in competition guidelines. Maybe he should be allowed to use different stuff. It's going to help him recover. And theoretically, I would say I agree with that to some extent. That, you know, like, yeah. Hey, maybe we don't need to be watching it quite so closely if the guy is just trying to make sure he can walk right again. And there's something to that that is resonating with me. And yet at the same time, there's people in that article, other doctors who are like, I don't know of any steroids that help a broken bone. That's what you were treating, right? Is that you broke your leg. What of these banned substances has been proven to help the recovery from that, and how? And so that is the thing. It's like they asked the doctor at some point about it, and he was just saying, like, he said, hey, I'm using a scientific approach with this stuff. And they said, okay, what, show us the study or whatever that shows these banned substances and how they help heal a broken leg. And he did not provide any specifics on that. And that, I think, is interesting because it's, in general, do I agree? Like, yeah, you might ought to get some leeway when you're not even thinking about competing. You're just thinking about recovering. Yeah, that makes some kind of sense to me, as long as that's available to everybody. That's also yes. The other tricky thing is it's like, does this guy who's a superstar and has a bunch of money and all, and has celebrity doctors at his disposal, does he get one treatment? And when Corey Hill broke his leg in the UFC, we're just sending you to the emergency room and you figure it out yourself from there. Like, everybody needs to have that same ability, that same access. The other interesting thing was them tying this to split with USADA. It seemed like USADA USADA definitely tried to suggest that was behind the split at the time. And then the UFC called them scumbags for suggesting that might have been part of the split.
Completely ruling it out, of course, when they called them scumbags. We're like, oh, well, that's the end of that. Didn't know there were scumbags.
The other thing where I kind of just shook my head and said, that ain't that just so MMA of us, is that, like you said, the MMA crowd's reaction to this report was, yeah, so what? We kind of knew he was doing that. We didn't really care. He didn't really fight. So it's not like it affected anybody. So what? And then this doctor who was named in the story, and this doctor, he is a celebrity doctor. There was a profile of him in the New Yorker not that long ago. He seems like a fascinating person with an interesting life. But he's already been told, okay, the Dodgers want to talk to you. You're the team doctor for the Dodgers and for the LA Rams. You know, Major League Baseball might want to hear from you. Maybe the NFL is going to end up wanting to hear from you, and the Rams are going to. And it's like, wouldn't it just be so MMA if the only person to suffer any sort of consequences for their involvement in this is the doctor who made the mistake of treating an MMA fighter? The fighter himself, the UFC, none of those people going to face any sort of consequences, because we're just used to that in this sport. We're used to crazy shit like that. The doctor is the one who might come away being like, I should have never, ever even picked up the phone when these people called me.
Absolutely. To your point earlier, it does kind of, the question for me, the broader questions are about level playing field. You know, when everyone rushing to defend McGregor, you're like, exactly like you said with Hill, like he breaks his leg, like, what happens? Is there this kind of defense if that happens for everyone? I know they laugh at me often on at the Ariel Wani show when I say, like, remember, this is a sport. And they go, no, I don't think it is anymore, PZ. But I'm like, but the illusion of sport needs to be there. Like, we need to have two people competing on a supposed level playing field. And when you kind of see the people rushing to defend McGregor in this situation, you do have those questions. Like, would this be the case if this was another guy, not well-known guy?
You know? No, I got to know Corey Hill pretty well. Corey Hill died a few years ago, but he dealt with nerve damage in his leg for the rest of his life because of that really nasty leg break. He basically had the same leg break Anderson Silva did. And, you know, he got like the standard of medical care that you or I would be able to get if like we broke our legs. But it wasn't the Conor McGregor standard of care where the celebrity doctor is going to help you out and then send you to special scientists to get you on some of that good. So the level playing field conversation, especially because if I'm another fighter, fighters get injured all the time. If I tore my rotator cuff or something, you know, I had some kind of injury that took me out for a while. And I saw this story, I'd be going, wait, why wasn't anybody helping me get on some of this stuff? Why didn't anybody tell me I could get out of the testing pool for a little while? I could do whatever I needed to do to feel like I recovered and got healthy again, and then I could get back in. You know, you just want everybody to have access to the same information and the same ability to do this stuff.
Ultimately, it doesn't affect them within the sport at all, does it?
No, I mean, at this point, I think the MMA world in general, the sports world in general, I think we all feel pretty differently about doping stuff these days. Plus, it's not like Conor McGregor had a squeaky clean image before. Like,
what
this
are you,
is
what
one
are you
of
talking about?
This is one of the least repugnant things he's ever been accused of doing. This is just like, hey, you know, you do what you got to do, buddy. You know, like, this is, people can look at it and be like, yeah, he wasn't really hurting anybody. He wasn't fighting on this. And even if he was, I don't think a whole lot of people are as precious about the idea that we all have to go in there for pure sports sake. It's not like where, you know, you're a baseball star and there's a little kid in the stands looking at you with tears in his eyes going, say it ain't so. This is, you know, this is a professional fighting, and we already had reason to think that this was not a guy who felt that the rules applied to him. So I don't think that he really suffers from it. And it also wasn't like we were looking at him and being like, the thing we remember Conor McGregor now for is being a big star, not necessarily like the greatest fighter. We've seen the limits of him as a fighter. It's the stardom thing that still resonates.
And to your point about Anderson Silva, like, I think he popped because he was taking something for his leg.
Yeah.
I fully believe that. I've always believed that.
And we felt understanding of that at the time. I feel
like it's an asterisk nearly, honestly, you know? I really do.
Yeah, I mean, when that came out, when it came out that he failed the test, I don't think people were going, your whole legacy is tainted, Anderson Silva. I think we went, would have been better if you hadn't failed the test for this, but also, we get it. You're an aging fighter coming back from a horrible injury. We could understand it, even if it didn't scientifically help you, we could understand how you might have thought you needed something extra to come back from that. Like, I felt like we had a little bit of sympathy for that, you know, we would not have had if it was like when it was Alistair Overeem who suddenly showed up and was like, I'm a heavyweight now and a walking action figure. And we went, bro, we know what you're doing.
Listen, I don't know, that horse meat, he said it was horse meat, dude. Apparently a lot of protein within the equestrian beef or whatever it is. Before we go, Katie Taylor has sold out Crow Park in 30 minutes. 82,000 tickets gone. Not surprised at all.
Did you get me one?
I
want to go. Come on.
I mean, I thought you'd be on the credential list, for God's sake. Do you know how many people text me after the fucking sale stopped? Like, you know, there's that window, you're in the queue. And they all just like, I've interviewed Katie Taylor twice on video, which doesn't help in this regard. They think you're best friends then. They're just at least 20 people. So what are we going to do about the tickets? What are we going to do? I'm like, what the fuck do you mean? Can you get tickets? Oh, of the 82,000 seats that just sold out in front of your fucking eyes, do I have any tickets? Like, what is wrong with you? Absolutely insane. It's going to be a crazy event, dude. There's Nikisa Badarian. Record setting, this will be the most tickets sold to a women's headline combat sports event, surpassing Ronda V. Holmes in Melbourne. Congrats to Queen Katie Taylor and Matchroom Boxing. Women boxing wins again. I thought that was a nice touch from Nikisa. Obviously, this is an Eddie Hearn event. Eddie Hearn has done the hard miles. There has been a bit of history between them. Famously, Eddie Hearn was not going to be allowed to step up on the podium after Katie Taylor's second win over Amanda Serrano. So Brian Peters obviously very involved in that as well. And yeah, I mean, a nice bit of business. Katie Taylor getting her hero's moment. And I honestly just can't wait to see it, dude. I never thought I'd see someone fight at this venue. And there's also, I feel like there's a bit of one-upmanship there for Eddie Hearn over Dana White, who teased this during McGregor's pomp so many times. We're going to do Crow Park. We're going to do all this shit. Well, Katie got it done. And are you still coming, even though I didn't get you a ticket? And you can get a media pass, obviously, Ben.
Hey, if they want to give me a credential, I feel like this is, you sold me on it. You, not only did you talk about it last week, you were sending in the group chat, you were sending me and Chuck videos from Crow Park. And I was just like, you know what? That does seem like something you'd like to be there for. So especially you talk about like, you're just glad to see somebody finally fighting in this venue. Me too. Cause now I am forced to admit that it might actually exist in this world.
Not until he gets there on the night will he fully accept. Okay, it's a fucking stadium. And you know, Katie Taylor was asked about this and it's funny to me. Like, I go to America, I look at your stadiums and they're absolutely unreal. Like, you guys wouldn't look at Crow Park and go, wow. Because you have fucking spaceships in the middle of every major city as of now. And I was just kind of like, what will be the American take on this place? It's full of history, of course. And it's like, as I've said before on this show, like it's a monument to Irish culture, basically. That's what it was built for. That's what it still is. But are people going to be really underwhelmed after hearing about this for like 15 years and just rock up and be like, yeah, it's just a... What? Big old piece of concrete there.
I do like the idea that the picture you've kind of painted as a stadium that's just in the middle of a neighborhood. Because that is one thing we don't do. We used to do that. Like, and there are still some of those old stadiums that are around there, like Fenway Park in Boston, where you're sort of like, yeah, that's just sort of plunked down in the middle of stuff. When you're walking around the city, you can see it. It's also, though, not as far as like capacity, everything, like not one of those huge cathedral kind of stadiums that we have built for college football and things like that. And I think there's a charm in doing it that way, especially it'll be a novelty like for somebody like me to go, because it's otherwise it's like you go to a city, you go to Seattle or something, and you're just sort of like, all right, I'm going to go see a Mariners game, go see a Seahawks game or something. I went to see the Winter Classic out there in Seattle a few years ago. And you're like, here I am in Seattle. There the stadium is. Outside the city, basically. Like, it's a long trek to get out there, and it's just sort of like in the middle of a district that is just sort of built up around, you know, stadium traffic that doesn't effectively exist any other time of year. So I think that there is a certain like old world charm to just be like, look at this. It's not huge, but we built it right here, right smack in the middle of our lives. I'd like to experience that.
Well, Jesus, I'm even more excited for it now. Are you excited for the World Cup, Ben? I mean, you're a soccer
Super
fan, you're
excited.
A big PSG fan.
Are Super you excited. Going? U.S. and Paraguay tonight. I've already got plans with my friends meet up down there at the watering hole.
Nice.
We got to win this one. Man, I was talking about this with some friends this week, talking about it with my CME co-host, Chad, this week about how 1994 we had the World Cup here. I was like 14, and I remember hearing all the time, it was just like, this is going to be a turning point for the way Americans regard soccer. There were articles in magazines, this is back when magazines still existed, you'd read about it, and they'd be like explaining soccer to you, explaining the rules, because they know Americans don't really know. And just, hey, this is going to be a point where Americans realize how huge soccer is. Our team is going to start to get good after that. We're going to start to put more resources into it. And now, here we are, like 30 years later, and we're still wildly mediocre at soccer. We're still not very good. And I feel like Americans have been hearing for so many years, like, don't worry, we're going to catch up. We're going to catch up, you guys. And then we won't be laughing stock anymore. And we haven't caught up at all. Every indication I've heard from people who are experts on this say, don't expect this to be the year we catch up. That if we could make it as far as the quarterfinals, that would be kind of a miracle. But like right now, we just got to focus on making it out of the group stage. And it's Americans aren't used to that, PC. We're used to going to the Olympics and winning a bunch of shit. We take it for granted. And so we have this sport. The world loves this sport. Everybody else is better at it than us. And we just get so damn frustrated by it. We're just so confused.
Not Ireland that didn't make it there, though. The biggest fucking, the more teams than ever before, but not us. No.
Little Couldn't twist of the knife. Little twist of the knife that we the biggest World Cup. Cabo Verde is there, you know?
Ireland. I hadn't heard of some there. Of the countries, honestly.
Aren't even countries. They aren't even independent.
Yeah, it's fucked. I love the World Cup. 94 is a special World Cup for me because it was the first one I was kind of aware of, because only like 3 for Italian 90, which in hindsight I love to watch too. But 94, I can remember being there, my little green jersey. The hydration was a massive issue for the teams back then because they didn't have these hydration breaks, which have been imposed for this World Cup. People very upset about them. You've lost the sanctity of the game. This is just an excuse for an advertisement break, which I do believe is true. But in 94, the Irish players were so sunburnt and dehydrated, and there was not allotted water breaks. So they came up with this idea, Ben, that the manager, Jack Charlton, and this was a very famous team in Ireland, he would fill bags of water and just fucking throw them at the players while they're running past. So you can see this like 70-year-old man just throwing bags, like these sealed bags of water, and just exploding off people's heads as they're running past.
That's him doing them a favor?
Apparently, well, that's, he was trying to. I mean, Jack wouldn't have been thought of as a scientific man, to be fair. Also, an incredible scene was John Aldridge trying to get on the pitch. He was subbed on, and the third official wouldn't bring him on. And there's just this amazing bit of footage of John Aldridge, who's a Scouser. He has a Liverpool accent. He plays for Ireland. Just fucking the third official out. He goes, "Let me on the fucking pitch." And everyone's like, "Jesus Christ, I did not know soccer players got down like that." But man, fucking love the World Cup. I'm very, very excited. So Ariel's team playing today. And then everybody else's team, America. One thing I will say, host nation, I think America have a, you know, I wouldn't be surprised. They're still there, still hanging around, semi-final. And then after that, it's like everyone's so broken up. Everyone's not used to these conditions. The U.S. boys could do something, man. I'm just saying.
Well, we don't want to get our hopes up too high. As far as us as the host nation, we've bollocksed it up a little bit already, as you might say. But the thing that gives me hope for this country is when I see stuff like Lawrence, Kansas rallying behind the Algerian team. And I don't know if it was like one of the university bands out there in Kansas learned the Algerian national anthem, play it for them when their team was coming out to practice. And that's the kind of stuff where it's just like, okay, we as individually as Americans, our institutions and our apparatuses do seem like they are rotting from within. That is concerning in a lot of ways. But individually as Americans, we can still show up and show out for people and be welcoming. And we can still remember that we are ourselves a nation of immigrants and we can welcome those from without. That does bring me joy. That and also seeing all the Scots descend on Boston.
Oh, my God.
That is very enjoyable for me.
The Scotch and the Irish usually form a Celtic wall, like when we qualify for the same. And if Ireland aren't there, Scotland will support us. And so we'll support Scotland for this one. But another cool thing, and that Kansas, I don't know if it was some kind of official who was speaking, it's gone viral all over the place. I've seen this guy everywhere and everyone's like, look at how fucking cool this is. One last thing to be aware of is the Netherlands have a tradition. When they play in the World Cup, the bus shows up and the fucking crowd come behind the bus. They walk to the arena behind the bus. So I can't remember what city they're playing in. They had to just ring someone and be like, yeah, you're going to have to close this street. And they're like, absolutely not. What do you mean? And he's like, listen, it's just better for you if you close the street.
You're going to close the street one way or another.
Yeah, we're going to have 20,000 people dressed in orange, losing their fucking minds, walking behind us. And they're an amazing crowd. And that's what it's all about. All these cultures coming together. This beautiful game, these beautiful people, I fucking love it. We can talk about it more after Sunday, of course. We need to have the big hoopla for the skirmish on the South Lawn. And look at Ben there. Can't wait. Are you fun? Like, now we can just enjoy it, right, Ben? Like, we can just enjoy it now.
You know what? Once the cage door closes, this is the best sports in the world. It's everything else around it that sometimes makes it hard to just turn your brain off and enjoy that. But I am looking forward to these fights. You do have a lot of good fights on this lineup. A lot of ones where I could see them going a bunch of different ways, and we should get some good action from it. And, you know, the UFC lightweight title going up for grabs. Ilya Topuria might grow several inches with a victory over Justin Gaethje, such is my understanding.
He expands. That's true. Andy, before we go, do we have any super chats?
Yeah.
They still love us. Love the show. Enjoy the weekend, fellas, from the Gator 117. We love you too, Gator.
We will enjoy the weekend. Thank you.
La Mancha MMA, $2. Praying for Belfast. Sucks what happened to Stephen. Belfast, in case you don't know, for those who might be uninformed, there was a guy videotaped beheading a man in the middle of the street.
What?
And it's kicked off. He didn't get beheaded, but he was attempting to behead him. But now it's kicked off all these anti-immigrant stuff all over the towns, and they're burning people out of their homes and everything like that. It's very ugly. Mick Conlon was talking about it online, just like, what the fuck is going on up there? Very, very bad. Obviously, terrible that a man was nearly beheaded in the street, but fucking poor reaction. So thank you for that, La Mancha MMA. Give old Belfast a Google there. Thank you, Andy. Well, that's it, Ben. We've been through it. We had
I did not expect to end the show on that. No, this is our first time hearing about this, and this is a weird way to end the show.
Yeah, wow. It is. It is really weird, and the footage is really fucked up. It's Yeah, it's kicking off. I'm basically just seeing it through online, but it's the first time, and I tell you, it was a bit troubling because it's the first time I've seen Sky News, which is our, like, I don't know what your biggest news is, like Fox or CNN or whatever. It's the first time I've seen, like, just a permanent aerial view of Belfast for a very long time. And just seeing fires pop up around Belfast, you're like, oh my God, the amount of, like, trauma you have from seeing that growing up with the troubles and everything, you're like, fucking hell, like, this is not good. But yeah, go on X. There's a lot of people fully in favor of it, of course. So who the fuck am I to say anything? You know what I mean? But the people I've spoken to in Belfast said it's fucking scary. So yeah, I hope it gets stopped. And obviously, I hope people don't get beheaded either. But you know what I mean? Sunday, baby, at the White House, we are gonna do a post show. There's gonna be a watch along, and the World Cup is on. Let's pick ourselves up, ladies and gentlemen, because I love yous very much. And I love Ben Folks, I love Andy, I love Oscar Losep, I love Chuck Mendenhall. And I love you all too, crackheads. We will see you next week. Enjoy the fights. Mwah.